and we who govern all men are governed by our women. Little by little, the legal situation of Roman women adapts to their practical situation. During the patrician oligarchy, each paterfamilias is an independent ruler within the republic. But when state power becomes established, it opposes the concentration of wealth and the arrogance of powerful families. Family courts bow to public justice, and woman acquires ever greater rights. Four powers originally limited her freedom. The father and the husband controlled her person, her guardian and manus her property. The state takes authority over the opposition of father and husband to restrict their rights. The state court will now rule over adultery cases, divorce, and so on. In the same way, guardians and manus destroy each other. In the interest of the guardian, the manus had already been separated from marriage. Later, the manus becomes an expedient that women use to escape their guardians, either by contracting fictitious marriages or by securing obliging guardians from their father or from the state. Under imperial legislation, guardianship will be entirely abolished. Woman simultaneously gains a positive guarantee of her independence. Her father is obliged to provide her with a dowry, and it will not go back to the agnates after the marriage's dissolution. Nor does it ever belong to her husband. A woman can at any moment demand restitution by a sudden divorce, which puts man at her mercy. In accepting the dowry, he sold his power, said Plautus. From the end of the Republic on, the mother's right to her children's respect was recognized as equal to the father's. She is granted custody of her children in case of guardianship or of the husband's bad conduct. When she had three children and the deceased had no heirs, a Senate decree, under Hadrian, entitled her to an ab intestat succession right for each of them. And under Marcus Aurelius, the Roman family's evolution was completed. From 178 on, the mother's children become her heirs over her male relatives. From then on, the family is based on coniunctio sanguinis, and the mother is equal to the father. The daughter inherits like her brothers. Nevertheless, the history of Roman law shows a tendency that contradicts the one just described, rendering the woman independent of the family. The central power takes her back under its guardianship and subjects her to various legal restraints. In fact, she would assume an unsettling importance if she could be both rich and independent. So what is conceded with one hand is taken away from her with the other. The Oppian law that banned luxury was voted when Hannibal threatened Rome. When the danger passed, women demanded its abrogation. In a famous speech, Cato asked that it be upheld, but a demonstration by matrons assembled in the public square carried the repeal against him. More severe laws were proposed as mores loosened, but without great success. They did little more than give rise to fraud. Only the Valeian Senate decree triumphed, forbidding women to intercede for others. Note, that is, to enter into contracts with another, depriving her of nearly every legal capacity. It is when woman is probably the most emancipated that the inferiority of her sex is proclaimed, a remarkable example of the male justification process already discussed. When her rights as girl, wife, or sister are no longer limited, she is refused equality with men because of her sex. The pretext for persecuting her becomes imbecility and fragility of the sex. The fact is that matrons did not put their newfound freedom to the best use, but it is also true that they were forbidden to take the best advantage of it. These two contradictory strains, an individualistic strain that tears woman from the family and a state-controlled strain that abuses her as an individual, result in an unbalanced situation for her. She can inherit, she has equal rights with the father concerning the children, she can will her property thanks to the institution of the dowry, she escapes conjugal restraints, she can divorce and remarry as she wishes. But she is emancipated only in a negative way because she is offered no employment for her vital forces. Economic independence remains abstract since it yields no political capacity. Therefore, lacking the power to act, Roman women demonstrate. They cause a ruckus in towns. They besiege the courts. They brew. They foment plots. They lay down prescriptions. They inflame civil wars. They march along the Tiber, carrying the statue of the mother of the gods, thus introducing Oriental divinities to Rome. In the year 114, the scandal of the Vestal Virgins breaks out, and their college is then disbanded. As public life and virtue are out of reach, and when the dissolution of the family renders the former private virtues useless and outdated, there is no longer any moral code for women. They have two choices, either to respect the same values as their grandmothers, or to no longer recognize any. The end of the first century and beginning of the second see numerous women living as companions and partners of their spouses, as in the time of the Republic. Plotina shares the glory and responsibilities of Trajan. Sabina becomes so famous for her good deeds that statues deify her while she is still alive. Under Tiberius, Sextia refuses to live on after Aemilius Scaurus, and Paetia to live on after Pomponius Labius. Paulina opens her veins at the same time as Seneca. Pliny the Younger makes Arria's Paetae non dolet famous. Martial admires the irreproachable wives and devoted mothers Claudia Rufina, Virginia, and Sulpicia. But numerous women refuse motherhood, and many women divorce. Laws continue to ban adultery. Some matrons even go so far as to register as prostitutes to avoid being constrained in their debaucheries. Note: Rome, like Greece, officially tolerated prostitution. There were two categories of courtesans, those living closed up in brothels, and others, bonae meretrices, freely exercising their profession. They did not have the right to wear the clothing of matrons. They had a certain influence on fashion, customs, and art, but they never held a position as lofty as the hetairas of Athens. Until then, Latin literature had always respected women. Then satirists went wild against them. They attacked, in fact, not women in general, but mainly contemporary women. Juvenal reproaches their hedonism and gluttony. He accuses them of aspiring to men's professions. They take an interest in politics, immerse themselves in court cases, debate with grammarians and rhetoricians, develop passions for hunting, chariot racing, fencing, and wrestling. But in fact, they rival men mainly because of their own taste for amusement and vice. They lack sufficient education for higher aims. And besides, no objective is even proposed to them. Action remains forbidden to them. The Roman woman of the ancient Republic has a place on earth, but she is still chained to it by lack of abstract rights and economic independence. The Roman woman of the decline is typical of false emancipation, possessing in a world where men are still the only masters, nothing but empty freedom. She is free for nothing. Chapter 4. The evolution of the feminine condition was not a continuous process. With the great invasions, all of civilization is put into question. Roman law itself is under the influence of a new ideology, Christianity, and in the centuries that follow, barbarians impose their laws. The economic, social, and political situation is overturned, and women's situation suffers the consequences. Christian ideology played no little role in women's oppression. Without a doubt, there is a breath of charity in the Gospels that spread to women as well as to lepers. Poor people, slaves, and women are the ones who adhere most passionately to the new law. In the very early days of Christianity, women who submitted to the yoke of the church were relatively respected. They testified along with men as martyrs, but they could nonetheless worship only in secondary roles. Deaconesses were authorized only to do lay work, caring for the sick or helping the poor. And although marriage is considered an institution demanding mutual fidelity, it seems clear that the wife must be totally subordinate to the husband. Through St. Paul, the fiercely anti-feminist Jewish tradition is affirmed. St. Paul commands self-effacement and reserve from women. He bases the principle of subordination of women to man on the Old and New Testaments. The man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man, and neither was man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. And elsewhere, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. In a religion where the flesh is cursed, the woman becomes the devil's most fearsome temptation. Tertullian writes, "Woman, you are the devil's gateway. You have convinced the one the devil did not dare to confront directly. It is your fault that God's son had to die. You should always dress in mourning and rags." St. Ambrose, "Adam was led to sin by Eve and not Eve by Adam. It is right and just that he whom she led into sin, she shall receive as master." And St. John Chrysostom, "Of all the wild animals, none can be found as harmful as woman." When canon law is written in the 4th century, marriage is treated as a concession to human failings, incompatible with Christian perfection. "Take up the hatchet and cut the roots of the sterile tree of marriage," writes St. Jerome. In the time of Gregory VI, when celibacy was imposed on priests, woman's dangerous character was more harshly asserted. All the fathers of the church proclaim her wretchedness. St. Thomas will remain true to this tradition, declaring that woman is only an occasional and incomplete being, a sort of failed man. "Man is the head of woman just as Christ is the head of man," he writes. "It is a constant that woman is destined to live under the authority of man and has no authority of her own." Thus, the only marriage regime canon law recognizes is by dowry, rendering woman helpless and powerless. Not only is she prohibited from male functions, but she is also barred from making court depositions, and her testimony holds no weight. The emperors are more or less under the influence of the church fathers. Justinian's legislation honors woman as spouse and mother, but subjugates her to those functions. Her helplessness is due not to her sex, but to her situation within the family. Divorce is prohibited, and marriage has to be a public event. The mother has the same authority over her children as the father, and she has equal rights to their inheritance. If her husband dies, she becomes their legal tutor. The Valaian Senate decree is modified. From that time on, she can intercede for the benefit of a third party, but she cannot contract for her husband. Her dowry becomes inalienable. It is her children's patrimony, and she is forbidden to dispose of it. In barbarian-occupied territories, these laws are juxtaposed with Germanic traditions. The German customs were unique. They had chiefs only in wartime. In peacetime, the family was an autonomous society. It seemed to be midway between matrilineal filiation clans and patriarchal gens. The mother's brother had the same power as the father and the same authority over their niece and daughter as her husband. In a society where all capacity was rooted in brute force, woman was entirely powerless, but the rights that were guaranteed to her by the twofold domestic powers on which she depended were recognized. Subjugated, she was nonetheless respected. Her husband purchased her, but the price of this purchase constituted a dowry that belonged to her. And besides, her father dowered her. She received her portion of the paternal inheritance and, in the case of parents being murdered, a portion of the fine paid by the murderer. The family was monogamous, adultery being severely punished and marriage respected. The woman still lived under wardship, but she was a close partner of her husband. In peace and in war, she shares his lot. She lives with him, she dies with him, says Tacitus. She went to war with him, brought food to the soldiers, and encouraged them by her presence. As a widow, part of her deceased husband's power was transmitted to her. Since her incapacity was rooted in her physical frailty, it was not considered an expression of moral inferiority. Some women were priestesses and prophets, so it could be assumed that their education was superior to men's. Among the objects that legally reverted to women in questions of inheritance were, later, jewelry and books. This is the tradition that continues into the Middle Ages. The woman is absolutely dependent on her father and husband. During Clovis's time, the mundium weighs on her throughout her life. Note, mundium, almost total legal guardianship over women by father and husband. Translation. But the Franks rejected Germanic chastity. Under the Merovingians and Carolingians, polygamy reigns. The woman is married without her consent and can be repudiated by her husband, who holds the right of life or death over her, according to his whim. She is treated like a servant. Laws protect her, but only in as much as she is the man's property and the mother of his children. Calling her a prostitute without having proof is considered an insult liable to a fine 15 times more than any insult to a man. Kidnapping a married woman is equivalent to a free man's murder. Taking a married woman's hand or arm is liable to a fine of 15 to 35 sous. Abortion is forbidden under threat of a 100 sous fine. Murder of a pregnant woman costs 4 times that of a free man. A woman who has proved herself fertile is worth 3 times a free man, but she loses all worth when she can no longer be a mother. If she marries a slave, she becomes an outlaw, and her parents have the right to kill her. She has no rights as an individual. But while the state is becoming powerful, the shift that had occurred in Rome occurs here as well. The wardship of the disabled, children, and women no longer belongs to family law but becomes a public office. Starting from Charlemagne, the mundium that weighs down the woman belongs to the king. He only intervenes at first in cases in which the woman is deprived of her natural guardians. Then, little by little, he confiscates the family powers. But this change does not bring about the Frank woman's emancipation. The mundium becomes the guardian's responsibility. His duty is to protect his ward. This protection brings about the same slavery for woman as in the past. When feudalism emerges out of the convulsions of the early Middle Ages, woman's condition looks very uncertain. What characterizes feudal law is the confusion between sovereign and property law, between public and private rights. This explains why woman is both put down and raised up by this system. She first finds herself denied all private rights because she lacks political capacity. Until the 11th century, order is based on force alone and property on armed power. A fief, legal experts say, is property held against military service. Woman cannot hold feudal property because she is incapable of defending it. Her situation changes when fiefs become hereditary and patrimonial. In Germanic law, some aspects of maternal law survived. As has already been shown, if there were no male heirs, the daughter could inherit. This leads, around the 11th century, to the feudal system's acceptance of female succession. However, military service is still required of the vassals, and woman's lot does not improve with her ability to inherit. She still needs a male guardian. The husband plays that role. He is invested with the title, holds the fief, and he has the usufruct of the goods. Like the Greek epikleros, woman is the instrument and not the bearer through which the domain is transmitted. That does not emancipate her. In a way, she is absorbed by the fief. She is part of the real property. The domain is no longer the family's thing as it was for Roman gens. It is the lord's property, and the woman also belongs to the lord. He is the one who chooses a spouse for her. When she has children, she gives them to him rather than to her husband. They will be vassals who will defend his property. She is therefore a slave of the domain and of its master through the protection of a husband who was imposed on her. Few periods of history seem harsher for woman's lot. An heiress means land and a chateau. Suitors fight over this prey, and the girl is sometimes not even 12 years old when her father or his lord gives her to some baron as a gift. The more marriages, the more domains for a man, and thus the more repudiations. The church hypocritically authorizes them. As marriage was forbidden between relatives up to the 7th degree, and as kinship was defined by spiritual relations such as godmother and godfather, as well as by blood relations, some pretext or other can always be found for an annulment. Many women in the 11th century were repudiated 4 or 5 times. Once widowed, the woman immediately has to accept a new master. In the Chanson de Geste, Charlemagne has, all at once, the widows of his barons who had died in Spain remarry. In Gérard de Vienne, the Burgundy Duchess goes herself to the king to demand a new spouse. My husband has just died, but what good is mourning? Find me a powerful husband, because I need to defend my land. Many epics show the king or lord dealing tyrannically with girls and widows. One also sees the husband treating the woman given to him as a gift without any respect. He abuses and slaps her, drags her by her hair, and beats her. All that Beaumanoir and Coutumes de Beauvaisis, Customs of Beauvaisis, asks is that the husband punish his wife reasonably. This warlike civilization has only scorn for women. The knight is not interested in women. His horse is a treasure of much higher value to him. In the epics, girls are always the ones to make the first step toward young men. Once married, they alone are expected to be faithful. The man dissociates them from his life. Cursed be the knight who takes counsel from a lady on when to joust. And in Renaud de Montauban, there is this diatribe. Go back into your painted and golden quarters. Sit ye down in the shade. Drink, eat, embroider, dye silk. But do not busy yourself with our affairs. Our business is to fight with the sword and steel. Silence. The woman sometimes shares the male's harsh life. As a girl, she excels in all physical exercises. She rides, hunts, hawks. She barely receives any education and is raised with no regard for modesty. She welcomes the chateau's guests, takes care of their meals and baths, and she pleasures them to sleep. As a woman, she sometimes has to hunt wild animals, undertake long and difficult pilgrimages. When her husband is far away, it is she who defends the seigneurie. These ladies of the manor, called viragos, are admired because they behave exactly like men. They are greedy, treacherous, and cruel, and they tyrannize their vassals. History and legend have bequeathed the memory of several of them. The Chatelaine Obi, after having a tower built higher than any donjon, then had the architect's head cut off so her secret would be kept. She chased her husband from his domain. He stole back and killed her. Mabel, Roger de Montgomery's wife, delighted in reducing her seigneurie's nobles to begging. Their revenge was to decapitate her. Julianne, bastard daughter of Henry I of England, defended the Chateau of Breteuil against him, luring him into an ambush for which he punished her severely. Such acts remain exceptional, however. Ordinarily, the lady spent her time spinning, praying for the dead, waiting for her spouse, and being bored. It has often been claimed that courtly love, born in the 12th century in the Mediterranean south of France, brought about an improvement in woman's lot. There are several opposing hypotheses as to its origins. According to some people, courtliness comes from the lord's relations with his young vassals. Others link it to Cathar heresies and the cult of the virgin. Still others say that profane love derives from the love of God in general. It is not so sure that courts of love ever existed. What is sure is that faced with Eve the sinner, the church comes to glorify the mother of the Redeemer. She has such a large following that in the 13th century it can be said that God was made woman. A mysticism of woman thus develops in religion. Moreover, leisure in chateau life enables the noble ladies to promote and nurture the luxury of conversation, politeness, and poetry. Women of letters such as Béatrice de Valentinois, Eleanor of Aquitaine, and her daughter Marie of France, Blanche of Navarre, and many others attract and patronize poets. First in the Midi and then in the North, culture thrives, giving women new prestige. Courtly love was often described as platonic. Chrétien de Troyes, probably to please his protector, banishes adultery from his novels. The only guilty love he depicts is that of Lancelot and Guinevere. But in fact, as the feudal husband was both a guardian and a tyrant, the wife sought a lover outside of marriage. Courtly love was a compensation for the barbarity of official customs. Love in the modern sense does not exist in antiquity except outside of official society, notes Engels. At the very point where antiquity broke off its penchant for sexual love, the Middle Ages took it up again with adultery. And this is the form that love will take as long as the institution of marriage lasts. While courtly love might ease woman's lot, it does not modify it substantially. Ideologies like religion and poetry do not lead to female liberation. Woman gains a little ground at the end of the feudal age for other reasons entirely. When the supremacy of royal power is imposed on feudatories, the lord loses a large part of his rights. His right, in particular, to decide on his vassals' marriages is progressively suppressed. At the same time, the feudal lord loses the use of his ward's property. The benefits attached to wardship fall into disuse. And when the service of the fief is converted to a monetary fee, wardship itself disappears. Woman was unable to perform military service, but she was as capable as a man of paying the financial obligations. The fief is then little more than a simple patrimony, and there is no longer any reason for the two sexes not to be placed on an equal footing. In fact, women in Germany, Switzerland, and Italy remain subjected to a perpetual wardship, but France accepts, in Beaumanoir's words, that a girl is worth a man. Germanic tradition gave women a defender as a guardian. When she no longer needs a defender, she goes without a guardian. As a sex, she is no longer taxed with incapacity. Unmarried or widowed, she has all the rights of man. Property grants her sovereignty. She governs the fief that she owns, meaning she dispenses justice, signs treaties, and decrees laws. She is even seen playing a military role, commanding troops, taking part in fighting. Before Joan of Arc, there were women soldiers, and however surprising La Pucelle is, she is not shocking. Nonetheless, so many factors converge to thwart woman's independence that they are never all abolished simultaneously. Physical weakness is no longer an issue, but feminine subordination remains useful to society in cases where the woman is married. Thus, marital power outlives the feudal regime. The paradox still being perpetuated today is established. The woman most fully integrated into society is the one with the fewest privileges in the society. In civil feudality, marriage has the same features as in military feudality. The husband remains the wife's guardian. When the bourgeoisie is formed, it observes the same laws. In common law as in feudal law, the only emancipation is outside marriage. The daughter and the widow have the same capacities as the man, but by marrying, the woman falls under the husband's guardianship and administration. He can beat her. He watches over her behavior, relations, and correspondence, and disposes of her fortune, not through a contract, but by the very fact of marriage. As soon as the marriage is consummated, Beaumanoir says, the possessions of each party are held in common by virtue of the marriage, and the man is the guardian of them. It is in the interest of property that the nobility and the bourgeoisie demand one master to administer it. The wife is not subordinated to the husband because she is judged basically incapable. When nothing else prevents it, woman's full capacities are recognized. From feudality to today, the married woman is deliberately sacrificed to private property. It is important to see that the greater the property owned by the husband, the greater this servitude. The propertied classes are those in which woman's dependence has always been the most concrete. Even today, the patriarchal family survives among rich landowners. The more socially and economically powerful man feels, the more he plays the paterfamilias with authority. On the contrary, shared destitution makes the conjugal link reciprocal. Neither feudality nor the church enfranchised woman. Rather, it was from a position of servitude that the patriarchal family moved to an authentically conjugal one. The serf and his wife owned nothing. They simply had the common use of their house, furniture, and utensils. Man had no reason to want to become master of woman who owned nothing, but the bonds of work and interest that joined them raised the spouse to the rank of companion. When serfdom is abolished, poverty remains. In small rural communities and among artisans, spouses live on an equal footing. Woman is neither a thing nor a servant. Those are the luxuries of a rich man. The poor man experiences the reciprocity of the bond that attaches him to his other half. In freely contracted work, woman wins concrete autonomy because she has an economic and social role. The farces and fabliaux of the Middle Ages reflect a society of artisans, small merchants, and peasants in which the husband's only privilege over his wife is to be able to beat her. But she pits craftiness against force to reestablish equality. However, the rich woman pays for her idleness with submission. In the Middle Ages, the woman still retained some privileges. She took part in local meetings in the villages. She participated in the primary meetings for the deputy's election to the Estates General. Her husband could exercise his own authority only over movables. His wife's consent was necessary to alienate real estate. The 16th century sees the codification of the laws perpetuated throughout the Ancien Régime. By that time, feudal habits and customs had totally disappeared, and nothing protects women from men's claims that they should be chained to the household. The influence of Roman law, so condescending for women, can be perceived here. As in Roman times, the violent diatribes against the stupidity and fragility of the sex were not at the root of the code, but are used as justifications. It is after the fact that men find reasons to act as it suits them. Among all the bad characteristics that women possess, one reads in the Songe du Verger, "I find that there are 9 principal ones. To begin with, a woman hurts herself as a result of her own nature. Second, women are by nature extremely stingy. Third, they are driven by sudden whims. Fourth, they are bad by their own volition. Fifth, they are imposters. Women are known to be false, and according to civil law, a woman may not be accepted as a witness to a will. A woman always does the opposite of what she is commanded to do. Women accuse themselves willingly and denounce their own vituperation and shame. They are crafty and malicious. St. Augustine said that a woman is a beast who is neither firm nor stable. She is hateful to the confusion of her husband. She nourishes wrongdoing and stands at the beginning of all the pleas and tensions, and is the path and road of all iniquity." Note, the Songe du Verger is a treatise of political doctrine, written first in Latin, 1370, and then in French, 1378. Title usually kept in French. Translation. Similar texts abound around this time. The interest of this one is that each accusation is meant to justify one of the provisions of the code against women and the inferior situation in which they are kept. Naturally, any male office is forbidden to them. The Valaian decree of the Senate is reinstated, depriving them of all civil capacity. Birthright and masculine privilege place them second in line for the paternal inheritance. Unmarried, the daughter remains under the father's guardianship. If he does not marry her off, he generally sends her to a convent. An unwed mother has the right to seek out the father, but such a right merely provides for the costs of lying in and the infant's food. A married woman becomes subject to the husband's authority. He determines the place of residence, directs the household, repudiates the adulterous wife, shuts her up in a monastery, or later obtains a lettre de cachet to send her to the Bastille. Note, lettre de cachet, letter with a seal. It carries an official seal, usually signed by the King of France, authorizing the imprisonment without trial of a named person. Translation. No deed is valid without his authorization. Everything the wife brings to the marriage becomes part of the dowry in the Roman meaning of the word. But as marriage is indissoluble, the husband has to die before the wife can recover her property, giving rise to the adage, "Uxor non est propie, socia sed sporatur fore." Note, the wife is not exactly a partner, but it is hoped she will become one. Translation. As she does not manage her capital, although she has rights to it, she does not have the responsibility for it. It does not provide any substance to her action. She has no concrete grasp on the world. Even her children belong to the father rather than to her, as in the time of the Eumenides. She gives them to her spouse, whose authority is far greater than hers, and who is the real master of her posterity. Even Napoleon will use this argument, declaring that just as a pear tree is the property of the owner of the pears, the wife is the property of the man to whom she provides children. The status of the French wife remains as such throughout the Ancien Régime. Little by little, jurisprudence will abolish the Valéan decree, but not until the Napoleonic Code does it disappear definitively. The husband is responsible for the wife's debts as well as her behavior, and she is accountable to him alone. She has almost no direct relations with public authorities or autonomous relations with anyone outside her family. She looks more like a servant in work and motherhood than an associate. Objects, values, and human beings that she creates are not her own property, but her family's, that is, man's, as he is the head. Her situation is far from being more liberal in other countries. It is, on the contrary, less liberal. Some maintained guardianship, and in all of them, the married woman's capacities are non-existent and moral standards strict. All the European codes were drafted on the basis of canon, Roman, and Germanic law. All were unfavorable to the woman, and all the countries recognized private property and the family, deferring to the demands of these institutions. In all these countries, one of the consequences of the honest wife's servitude to the family is prostitution. Hypocritically kept on society's fringes, prostitutes fill a highly important role. Christianity pours scorn on them but accepts them as a necessary evil. "Getting rid of the prostitutes," said St. Augustine, "will trouble society by dissoluteness." Later, St. Thomas, or at least the theologian that signed his name to Book 4, of De Regimini Principium, asserted, "Remove public women from society, and debauchery will disrupt it by disorder of all kinds. Prostitutes are to a city what a cesspool is to a palace. Get rid of the cesspool, and the palace will become an unsavory and loathsome place." In the early Middle Ages, moral license was such that women of pleasure were hardly necessary. But when the bourgeois family became institutionalized and monogamy rigorous, man obviously had to go outside the home for his pleasure. In vain did one of Charlemagne's capitularies vigorously forbid it. In vain did St. Louis order prostitutes to be chased out of the city in 1254 and brothels to be destroyed in 1269. In the town of Damietta, Joinville tells us, prostitutes' tents were adjacent to the king's. Later, attempts by Charles IX of France and Marie Therese of Austria in the 18th century also failed. The organization of society made prostitution necessary. Prostitutes, Schopenhauer would pompously say later, are human sacrifices on the altar of monogamy. And Lecky, a historian of European morality, expressed the same idea. Supreme type of vice, prostitutes are the most active guardians of virtue. Their situation and the Jews were often rightly compared. Usury and money lending were forbidden by the church, exactly as extraconjugal sex was. But society can no more do without financial speculators than free love, so these functions fell to the damned castes. They were relegated to ghettos or reserved neighborhoods. Note, those coming to Sisteron by the Pépin Passage, like the Jews, owed a toll of 5 sols to the ladies of Sainte-Claire, Bauteau. In Paris, loose women worked in pens where they arrived in the morning and left after the curfew had tolled. They lived on special streets and did not have the right to stray, and in most other cities, brothels were outside town walls. Like Jews, they had to wear distinctive signs on their clothes. In France, the most common one was a specific colored aglet hung on the shoulder. Silk, fur, and honest women's apparel were often prohibited. They were, by law, taxed with infamy, had no recourse whatsoever to the police and the courts, and could be thrown out of their lodgings on a neighbor's simple claim. For most of them, life was difficult and wretched. Some were closed up in public houses. Antoine de Lalaing, a French traveler, left a description of a Spanish establishment in Valencia in the late 15th century. The place, he said, was about the size of a small city, surrounded by walls with only one door, and in the front of it, there were gallows for criminals that might be inside. At the door, a man appointed to this task takes the canes of those wishing to enter and tells them that if they want to hand over their money, and if they have the money, he will give it to the porter. If it is stolen overnight, the porter will not answer for it. In this place, there are three or four streets full of small houses, in each of which are prettily and cleanly dressed girls in velvet and satin. There are almost 300 of them. Their houses are well kept and decorated with good linens. The decreed price is 4 pennies of their money, which is the equivalent of our gros. There are taverns and cabarets. It is not easy to recognize these houses by daylight, while at night or in the evening the girls are seated at their doorways with pretty lamps hanging near them in order to make it easier to see them at leisure. There are 2 doctors appointed and paid by the town to visit the girls every week in order to discover if they have any disease or intimate illness. If the town is stricken with any sickness, the lords of the place are required to maintain the girls at their expense, and the foreigners are sent away to any place they wish to go. Note, de Reifenberg, Dictionnaire de la Conversation, Femme et Fils de Folvie, Dictionary of Conversation, Women and Girls of the Low Life, translation of Old French by Gabriel Spiegel. Translation. The author even marvels at such effective policing. Many prostitutes lived freely. Some of them earned their living well. As in the period of the courtesans, high gallantry provided more possibilities for feminine individualism than the life of an honest woman. A condition unique to France is that of the unmarried woman. Legal independence is in stark and shocking contrast to the wife's servitude. She is an oddity, and so customs hasten to withdraw everything law grants her. She has total civil capacity, but those laws are abstract and empty. She has no economic autonomy, no social dignity, and generally the spinster remains hidden in the shadow of the paternal family or finds others like her behind convent walls. There she knows no other form of freedom but disobedience and sin, just as decadent Roman women were emancipated only by vice. Negativity continues to be women's lot, as long as their emancipation remains negative. In such conditions, it is clear how rare it was for a wife to act or merely to make her presence felt. Among the working classes, economic oppression cancels out sexual inequality, but it deprives the individual of opportunities. Among the nobility and bourgeoisie, the wife is abused because of her sex. She has a parasitic existence. She is poorly educated. She needs exceptional circumstances if she is to envisage and carry out any concrete project. Queens and regents have that rare good fortune. Their sovereignty exalts them above their sex. French Salic law denies women the right of access to the throne, but they sometimes play a great role beside their husbands or after their deaths. For example, Saint Clotilda, Saint Radegunda, and Blanche of Castile. Convent life makes woman independent of man. Some abbesses wield great power. Héloïse gained fame as an abbess as much as a lover. In the mystical, thus autonomous, relation that binds them to God, feminine souls draw their inspiration and force from a virile soul, and the respect society grants them enables them to undertake difficult projects. Joan of Arc's adventure is something of a miracle. And it is, moreover, a very brief adventure. But Saint Catherine of Siena's story is meaningful. She creates a great reputation in Siena for charitable activity and for the visions that testify to her intense inner life within a very normal existence. She thus acquires the necessary authority for success generally lacking in women. Her influence is invoked to hearten those condemned to death, to bring back to the fold those who are lost, to appease quarrels between families and towns. She is supported by the community that recognizes itself in her, which is how she is able to fulfill her pacifying mission. preaching submission to the Pope from city to city, carrying on a vast correspondence with bishops and sovereigns, and finally chosen by Florence as ambassador to go and find the Pope in Avignon. Queens by divine right and saints by their shining virtues are assured of support in the society that allows them to be men's equal. Of others, a silent modesty is required. The success of a Christine de Pizan is due to exceptional luck. Even so, she had to be widowed and burdened with children for her to decide to earn her living by her pen. Altogether, men's opinion in the Middle Ages is not favorable to women. Courtly poets did not exalt love. Many codes of courtly love appear, such as André Le Chapelain's poem and the famous Roman de la Rose, in which Guillaume de Lorris encourages young men to devote themselves to the service of ladies. But against this troubadour-inspired literature are pitted bourgeois-inspired writings that cruelly attack women. Fabliaux, farces, and plays criticize women for their laziness, coquetry, and lust. Their worst enemies are the clergy. They incriminate marriage. The church made it a sacrament and yet prohibited it for the Christian elite. This is the source of the contradiction of the Querelle des Femmes. Note, Querelle des Femmes, a literary quarrel traced to Christine de Pizan's objection to the portrayal of women in the Roman de la Rose, voiced in her Épître à Dieu d'Amour, 1399, Epistle to the God of Love, a debate that helped nurture literary production throughout the early modern period. Translation. It is denounced with singular vigor in the Lamentations of Metellus, famous in its time, published 15 years after the first part of the Roman de la Rose, and translated into French 100 years later. Matthew lost his clergy by taking a wife. He cursed his marriage, cursed women and marriage in general. Why did God create woman if there is this incompatibility between marriage and clergy? Peace cannot exist in marriage. It had to be the devil's work, or else God did not know what he was doing. Matthew hopes that woman will not rise on Judgment Day, but God responds to him that marriage is a purgatory, thanks to which heaven is reached, and carried to the heavens in a dream, Matthew sees a legion of husbands welcoming him to the shouts of "Hear, hear, the true martyr." Jean de Meung, another cleric, is similarly inspired. He enjoins young men to get out from under the yoke of women. First, he attacks love. Love is hateful country. Love is amorous hate. He attacks marriage that reduces man to slavery, that dooms him to be cuckolded, and he directs a violent diatribe against woman. In return, woman's champions strive to demonstrate her superiority. Here are some of the arguments apologists for the weaker sex drew on until the 17th century. Mulier perfectur viro scilicet. Materia, quia adam factus est, de limo terrae, iva de costa adae. Loco, quia adam factus est, extra paradisum, iva in paradiso. In conceptione, quia mulier conceput deum, quid homo non potuit. Apparitione, quia Christus apparuit, mulieri post mortem resurrectionem, scilicet Magdalene. Exaltatione, quia mulier exaltata est, super chorus angelorum, scilicet Beata Maria. Note, woman is superior to man, namely, materially, because Adam was made of clay, Eve from one of Adam's ribs. In terms of place, because Adam was created outside of paradise, Eve in paradise. In terms of conception, because woman conceived God, something man couldn't do. In terms of appearance, because Christ after his death appeared to a woman, namely Magdalene. In terms of glorification, because a woman was glorified above the choir of angels, namely Blessed Mary. To which their opponents replied that if Christ first appeared to women, it is because he knew they were talkative, and he was in a hurry to make his resurrection known. The quarrel continues throughout the 15th century. The author of The 15 Joys of Marriage indulgently describes the misfortunes of poor husbands. Eustache Deschamps writes an interminable poem on the same theme. It is here that the quarrel of the Roman de la Rose begins. This is the first time a woman takes up her pen to defend her sex. Christine de Pizan attacks the clerics energetically in The Epistle to the God of Love. The clerics rise up immediately to defend Jean de Meung, but Gerson, chancellor of the University of Paris, takes Christine's side. He writes his treatise in French to reach a wide public. Martine Lefranc throws the indigestible Lady's Chaperone, still being read 200 years later, onto the battlefield. Note, the correct title is Le Champion des Dames, circa 1441, The Lady's Champion. Translation. And Christine intervenes once again. Her main demand is for women's right to education. If the custom were to put little girls in school and they were normally taught sciences like the boys, they would learn as perfectly and would understand the subtleties of all the arts and sciences as they do. In truth, this dispute concerns women only indirectly. No one dreams of demanding a social role for them other than what they are assigned. It is more a question of comparing the life of the cleric to the state of marriage. It is a masculine problem brought up by the church's ambiguous attitude to marriage. Luther settles this conflict by rejecting the celibacy of priests. Woman's condition is not influenced by this literary war. While railing against society as it is, the satire of farces and fabliaux does not claim to change it. It mocks women but does not plot against them. Courtly poetry glorifies femininity, but such a cult does not in any way imply the assimilation of the sexes. The querelle is a secondary phenomenon in which society's attitude is reflected but which does not modify it. It has already been said that the wife's legal status remained practically unchanged from the early 15th century to the 19th century. But in the privileged classes, her concrete condition does change. The Italian Renaissance is a period of individualism propitious to the burgeoning of strong personalities, regardless of sex. There were some women at the time who were powerful sovereigns, like Jeanne of Aragon, Joan of Naples, and Isabella d'Este. Others were adventurer condottieri who took up arms like men. Thus, Girolamo Riario's wife fought for Forli's freedom. Hippolyta Fioramenti commanded the Duke of Milan's troops, and during the siege of Pavia, led a company of noblewomen to the ramparts. To defend their city against Montluc, Sienese women marshaled 3,000 female troops commanded by women. Other Italian women became famous thanks to their culture or talents. For example, Isotta Nogarola, Veronica Gambara, Gaspara Stampa, Vittoria Colonna, who was Michelangelo's friend, and especially Lucrezia Tornabuoni, mother of Lorenzo and Giuliano de' Medici, who wrote, among other things, hymns and a life of St. John the Baptist and the Virgin. A majority of these distinguished women were courtesans, joining free moral behavior with free thinking, ensuring their economic autonomy through their profession. Many were treated by men with deferential admiration. They protected the arts and were interested in literature and philosophy, and they themselves often wrote or painted. Isabella da Luna, Caterina di San Celso, and Imperia, who was a poet and musician, took up the tradition of Aspasia and Phryne. For many of them, though, freedom still takes the form of license. The orgies and crimes of these great Italian ladies and courtesans remain legendary. This license is also the main freedom found in the following centuries for women whose rank or fortune liberates them from common morality. In general, it remains as strict as in the Middle Ages. As for positive accomplishments, they are possible only for a very few. Queens are always privileged. Catherine de' Medici, Elizabeth of England, and Isabella the Catholic are great sovereigns. A few great saintly figures are also worshipped. The astonishing destiny of Saint Teresa of Avila is explained approximately in the same way as Saint Catherine's. Her self-confidence is inspired by her confidence in God. By carrying the virtues connected with her status to the highest, she garners the support of her confessors and the Christian world. She is able to emerge beyond a nun's ordinary condition. She founds and runs monasteries. She travels, takes initiatives, and perseveres with a man's adventurous courage. Society does not thwart her. Even writing is not effrontery. Her confessors order her to do it. She brilliantly shows that a woman can raise herself as high as a man when, by an astonishing chance, a man's possibilities are granted to her. But in reality, such possibilities are very unequal. In the 16th century, women are still poorly educated. Anne of Brittany summons many women to the court, where previously only men had been seen. She strives to form a retinue of girls of honor, but she is more interested in their upbringing than in their culture. Among women who a little later distinguish themselves by their minds, intellectual influence, and writings, most are noble women. The Duchess of Retz, Madame de Lignerolles, the Duchess of Rohan, and her daughter Anne. The most famous were princesses, Queen Margot and Margaret of Navarre. Pernette du Guier seems to have been a bourgeois, but Louise l'Abbé is undoubtedly a courtesan. In any case, she felt free to behave unconventionally. Women in the 17th century will continue to distinguish themselves essentially in intellectual spheres. Social life and culture are spreading. Women play a considerable role in salons. By the very fact they are not involved in the construction of the world, they have the leisure to indulge in conversation, the arts, and literature. They are not formally educated, but through discussions, readings, and instruction by private preceptors or public lectures, they succeed in acquiring greater knowledge than their husbands. Mademoiselle de Gournay, Madame de Rambouillet, Mademoiselle de Scudéry, Madame de Lafayette, and Madame de Sévigné enjoy great reputations in France. And outside France, similar renown is associated with the names of Princess Elizabeth, Queen Christine, and Mademoiselle de Schurman, who corresponded with the whole scholarly world. Thanks to this culture and the ensuing prestige, women manage to encroach on the masculine universe. From literature and amorous casuistry, many ambitious women slide toward political intrigue. In 1623, the papal nuncio wrote, "In France, all the major events, all the important plots, most often depend on women." The Princesse de Condé foments the women's conspiracy. Anne of Austria readily takes the advice of the women surrounding her. Richelieu lends an indulgent ear to the Duchesse d'Aiguillon. The roles played by Madame de Montbazon, the Duchesse de Chevreuse, Mademoiselle de Montpensier, the Duchesse de Longueville, Anne de Gonzague, and many others in the Fronde are well known. Lastly, Madame de Maintenon is a brilliant example of the influence a skillful woman advisor could wield on state affairs. Organizers, advisors, and schemers, women assure themselves of a highly effective role by oblique means. The Princesse des Ursins in Spain governs with more authority, but her career is brief. Alongside these great noble women, a few personalities assert themselves in a world that escapes bourgeois constraints. A hitherto unknown species appears, the actress. The presence of a woman on stage is noted for the first time in 1545. In 1592, there is still only one. At the beginning of the 17th century, most of them are actors' wives. They then become more and more independent both on stage and in their private lives. As far as the courtesan is concerned, after being Phryne or Imperia, she finds her highest incarnation in Ninon de l'Enclos. From capitalizing on her femininity, she surpasses it. From living among men, she takes on virile qualities. Her independent moral behavior disposes her to independent thinking. Ninon de l'Enclos brought freedom to the highest point a woman could at that time. In the 18th century, woman's freedom and independence continue to grow. Customs remain strict in principle. Girls receive no more than a cursory education. They are married off or sent to a convent without being consulted. The bourgeoisie, the rising class that is being consolidated, imposes a strict morality on the wife. But on the other hand, with the nobility breaking up, the greatest freedom of behavior is possible for women of the world. And even the haute bourgeoisie is contaminated by these examples. Neither convent nor conjugal home can contain the woman. Once again, for the majority of women, this freedom remains negative and abstract. They limit themselves to the pursuit of pleasure. But those who are intelligent and ambitious create avenues for action for themselves. Salon life once again blossoms. The roles played by Madame Geoffrin, Madame du Deffand, Mademoiselle de l'Espinasse, Madame d'Epinay, and Madame de Tencin are well known. Protectors and inspiration, women make up the writer's favorite audience. They are personally interested in literature, philosophy, and sciences. Like Madame du Châtelet, for example, they have their own physics workshops or chemistry laboratory. They experiment, they dissect, they intervene more actively than ever before in political life, one after the other. Madame de Prie, Madame de Mailly, Madame de Châteauneuf, Madame de Pompadour, and Madame du Barry govern Louis XV. There is barely a minister without his egeria, to such a point that Montesquieu thinks that in France everything is done by women. They constitute, he says, a new state within the state. And Collet writes on the eve of 1789, "They have so taken over Frenchmen, they have subjugated them so greatly that they think about and feel only for themselves." Alongside society women, there are also actresses and prostitutes who enjoy great fame. Sophie Arnoux, Julie Talma, and Adrienne Lecouvreur. Throughout the Ancien Régime, the cultural domain is the most accessible to women who try to assert themselves. Yet none reached the summits of a Dante or a Shakespeare. This can be explained by the general mediocrity of their condition. Culture has never been the privilege of any but the feminine elite, never of the masses, and masculine geniuses often come from the masses. Even privileged women encountered obstacles that barred their access to the heights. Nothing stopped the ascent of a Saint Teresa, a Catherine of Russia, but 1,000 circumstances conspired against the woman writer. In her small book, A Room of One's Own, Virginia Woolf enjoyed inventing the destiny of Shakespeare's supposed sister. While he learned a little Latin, grammar, and logic in school, she was closed up at home in total ignorance. While he poached, ran around in the countryside, and slept with local women, she was mending kitchen towels under her parents' watchful eyes. If, like him, she bravely left to seek her fortune in London, she could not become an actress earning her living freely. Either she would be brought back to her family and married off by force, or seduced, abandoned, and dishonored, she would commit suicide out of despair. She could also be imagined as a happy prostitute, a Moll Flanders, as Daniel Defoe portrayed her, but she would never have run a theater and written plays. In England, Virginia Woolf notes, women writers always engender hostility. Dr. Johnson compared them to a dog's walking on his hinder legs. It is not done well, but you are surprised to find it done at all. Artists care about what people think more than anyone else. Women narrowly depend on it. It is easy to imagine how much strength it takes for a woman artist simply to dare to carry on regardless. She often succumbs in the fight. At the end of the 17th century, Lady Winchelsea, a childless noblewoman, attempts the feat of writing. Some passages of her work show she had a sensitive and poetic nature, but she was consumed by hatred, anger, and fear. "Alas, a woman that attempts the pen, such an intruder on the rights of men, such a presumptuous creature is esteemed, the fault by no virtue can be redeemed." Note, Beauvoir shortened and paraphrased this quatrain in the French text, translation. Almost all her work is filled with indignation about woman's condition. The Duchess of Newcastle's case is similar. Also a noblewoman, she creates a scandal by writing, "Women live like cockroaches or owls. They die like worms," she furiously writes. insulted and ridiculed, she had to shut herself up in her domain, and in spite of a generous temperament and going half mad, she produced nothing more than wild imaginings. It is not until the 18th century that a bourgeois widow, Mrs. Aphrabenne, lived by her pen like a man. Note, discrepancy. In fact, Mrs. Aphrabenne, dramatist and novelist, lived from 1640 to 1689. Translation. Others followed her example, but even in the 19th century, they were often obliged to hide. They did not even have a room of their own. That is, they did not enjoy material independence, one of the essential conditions for inner freedom. As has already been seen, because of the development of social life and its close link to intellectual life, French women's situation is a little more favorable. Nevertheless, people are largely hostile to the blue stockings. During the Renaissance, noble women and intellectuals inspire a movement in favor of their sex. Platonic doctrines imported from Italy spiritualize love and woman. Many well-read men strive to defend her. La nef des dames vertueuses, the ship of virtuous ladies, Le Chevalier des Dames, the Lady Chevalier, and so on were published. Erasmus in Le Petit Sénat, the Little Senate, gives the floor to Cornelia, who unabashedly details the grievances of her sex. Men are tyrants. They treat us like toys. They make us their launderers and cooks. Erasmus demands that women be allowed to have an education. Cornelius Agrippa, in a very famous work, Déclamation de la noblesse et de l'excellence du sexe féminin, Declamation on the Nobility and Preeminence of the Female Sex, devotes himself to showing feminine superiority. He takes up the old Kabbalistic arguments, Eve means life and Adam earth. Created after man, woman is more finished than he. She is born in paradise, he outside. When she falls into the water, she floats, man sinks. She is made from Adam's rib and not from earth. Her monthly cycles cure all illnesses.